Musicians and music lovers all over Nova Scotia and indeed Canada were saddened to hear of the passing of conductor, arranger, and composer Ron McKay. McKay began his musical career with the Navy Band in Halifax. He played the French horn. When he retired, he became a bandmaster and a conductor in the school music programs. Thousands of kids went through his band programs. Many of those went on to distinguish themselves as music professionals, some working as music educators, others performing with symphonies, including Symphony Nova Scotia, and others still leading top university music programs. McKay was also a friend of the adult musician, and that's why his friends and former students and colleagues got together last fall at St. Anne's Gaelic College in St. Anne's, Cape Breton, to pay tribute to the man. There were several conductors on hand that weekend. Rowan Fitzgerald from Prince Edward Island, Maggie Helms from the mainland, Laura Mercer from Cape Breton, and of course, Ron McKay himself. We have a chance to hear that concert a little later on Island Echoes. But before all of that, I did get a chance to sit down with Ron McKay and ask him about his work and about his musical beginnings. Here's that conversation. When did you first pick up the French horn?
That's kind of funny, because when I was in the Navy, I first started in the Navy, I was a baritone player, and I was on probation. That means if you could play good enough, they keep it, otherwise you had to go back being a cook, which I was destined to be, and that's not the kind of cook you're thinking about. These guys weren't gourmet cooks. Anyway, they asked me, after I played it for a while, would I like to switch to alto horn? When they asked me to switch to alto horn, I said, well, as long as after I played it a year or so, I can switch to trumpet, because that's what I wanted to play, I thought at the time. I said, so yes, you go, you get your first great trade group level, but we'll consider that. So I said, okay, so I worked a whole year, my butt off in this alto horn. And I got my trade group one, I walked in after I got it, and I says, you promised me that I could switch to trumpet. He said, well, before he switched to trumpet, he says, there's a triangular-shaped case out in the band room. Just come in, new instruments. Why don't you try that horn? It's a French horn. So I said, okay. So I went out, and I picked it up, and everything worked. And it wasn't a particularly new model of horn. Actually, the Boussinghawk's single F horn, the patent was in 1896. We're talking 1948. So I picked up the French horn, and I went back in about a week later and said, I don't want to drop it, forget it. And I just stayed with it. The only problem was that there were no French horn teachers in the area. The closest was Boston or Montreal. So at $50 a month, you can't even go to get the lessons. So I just read books and practiced and practiced and practiced. And they sent me to Cornwallis for 2 years for the band there, so I got lots of time to practice. But then it was funny, I came to Halifax, back to Halifax, I was on leave. And they just started the Nova Scotia Opera Company again, and they were doing Don Giovanni. And my friend was playing horn, and I was sitting there listening, enjoying myself. And all of a sudden, but the second day of rehearsal, they phoned up. The dress rehearsal, they phoned up, and said, "Could I take up do the horn because Mr. Stitt is ill." I said, gee, I don't know. I'll just come up and give it a try. We'll do it. You know, if I find anything, I'll just wave you off, which they did quite considerably. So my first thing into orchestra, I'm playing French horn in a different kind of professional capacity, was playing Don Giovanni by sight. Now, a lot of people don't realize it, but there's 32 transpositions in that. And for a green horn player, it's pretty well just played an F horn, period. That was quite a challenge. But the conductor there, Alfred Stromberg, used to bring me up to his house, and we'd go over all these Mozart pieces and pieces. But he just sit down and write them up by hand, and he got me playing in the orchestra. So from that, from 1952 on to about 58, I was playing horn all over Halifax. I was doing a fella came into the symphony. They brought a guy in because you can't be in the Navy, and I took some lessons from him. That was my first lesson. I'd already played couple of years professionally on CBC doing all those live dramas. Man, that's really stuff, you know, to teeth on, I'll tell you. It's really difficult material. So I was doing horn there, so that's kind of what I just worked my butt off.
How long were you in the Navy?
20 years.
You were the... Now, okay, The chief. Now, what, for those of us who don't understand about Navy lingo, what does that mean?
Chief petty officer. There's two chiefs petty officers, chief petty officer, second class and first class. And it generally goes by seniority. Once you're a chief, you're already qualified for chief second, first class until someone retires. So I was a chief petty officer, second class. I probably would have went higher if I'd stayed, but I left 5 years early. I was supposed to stay for 25 years. But what a chief does is pretty well an assistant band director. At Stadacona at the time, we had five chief petty officers. So you took turns who was going to conduct the band. But you never got anything too, you know, official. It's always a parade, or maybe they send you to do a mess dinner. But then when they went to go to sea, see, none of the officers would go to sea. The chief became a band director, so you had your own band. And most of the bands were like 15 to 18 pieces. And you'd have to do concerts and parades and everything with this 15-piece band, most of who they were people they didn't want in the senior band because either they weren't good enough or they were drunks. So it was quite a challenge to to keep this band sober and keep them on the waves. I was lucky. I only did that. I did a couple of ones where I wasn't actually attached to the ship. But the only time I was attached to a ship for any length of time was the Bonaventure. And that was his last trip, yeah.
And then you decided to teach.
Yes.
And you ended up in Truro. Now, how did you end up in Truro?
Well, the ship's band or the band that went to sea was stationed in Shearwater, and there's an officer there named Lieutenant Peter Medcalf. We were very good friends. And he was down going to Truro and conducting the Truro concert band, community band. And we get talking, and he says, you know, and he used to let me conduct all the time at Shearwater. I was conducting more than he was, and I'd just get stuff ready, he'd do it. And he said, you know, it's easy to come in here and conduct military musicians because they're going to do what you tell them, even if it's wrong, totally wrong. And he says, however, what you want to do is get yourself in a situation where you're going to have to teach while you're on the stand, and as you get all the valuable instruction that way, and it's a big, good experience for him. And he says, then he went on and says, I'm going to out west. I'm being drafted out west. And so I'd like you to, if you would like, go down and try to work with this band. So I said, oh, sure, I wouldn't mind doing that. So I started going and taking this place. In the meantime, I had a little tip-to-do with the Navy because I wanted to become a commissioned officer, and the new officer came in and withdrew my commission. So I said, I was 38, so I got to make a decision. Whether I'm going to sit here and push pencils or go out and do some music. So I said, I chose the music, even though I starved to death about 5 years, but I still did it. And so that's how I was doing the community band, but then the music teacher for the junior high school left. So the principal asked me would I might coming an hour or two early and work at the school band until they got a new teacher. Well, they never got a new teacher. They conned me into staying there, so it was great.
In that band, you had 350 kids who went on to professional careers. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that's disproportionate.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. I think it's just that I know a lot of people think, well, I was trying to make professional musicians out of them. I wasn't. I was just trying to make musicians out of them. And if a student comes and says, Mr. McKay, I thought I'd study music and become a professional musician, I'd treat them tough, look really tough. And I'd give them, he says, what? And they say, gee, I'm really trying to do this, and you're really picking on me all the time. He says, where do you get out of here? You know, it's a whole different story. I mean, I can send you, I might personally think you're a fabulous player, but when you go to university in that first year, everybody there is a fabulous student from another school. So remember, you've got one heck of a lot of work to do. And I was always straight ahead with the kids like that. So, but anyway, they made up their minds. I didn't go say, hey, you should be a professional musician. That's a lot of crock, because it takes a little bit more than just saying it. Doing it is another situation. And it just happened that at that time, in between this, the late 69s into the 80s, the bands in the province were just flourishing, you know, and it was the thing to do. So I had a little help that way. But that's just what happened. And I ran into a girl the other day. Where was I now? I was at something, and this girl came out, don't you remember me? And I said, oh, yeah. And so the last person I imagined in my school band would be a music teacher. a band teacher. She says, oh, yes, I'm a band teacher. No, she says, you must remember me. And as soon as I kept looking, oh, yeah, I knew you. But I just could not fit her in that position. Been teaching band for 5 years in Ontario, Toronto. Now she's in Dartmouth. So they're always adding up. So there's composers and arrangers and Jack Brunell of that.
Let me ask you this question. Those are the professionals. How many kids went through your band program who ended up in community bands or ended up heading up band parents associations or ended up in music in an amateur way?
I don't know. I never thought to calculate that, because a lot of times when you're a professional, you mix your job. Like my son, he does a junior high school program, very successful one. But he's also a professional musician, and on top of that, he's the president of the Musicians Union. So you see them in that respect. Or some just go teaching and don't do schools at all. But it's amazing to try and figure that out. And most of the ones that do schools are not here. They're out in Ontario and out west and all over the place, so I don't really hear about them.
Everybody I talk to talks about your influence as a person, the generosity of spirit, the mentoring, all of that. Was that something that you were, that one day you woke up and said, I'm going to be a mentor, this is what I'm going to do, or did that just come naturally to you?
It just came. In my family, you're either a dairyman or a minister. That's the two lines they took. Good Scots blood, you know. And I think a lot of it has to do with what I didn't get. Like when I was a teenager, the war was on. Teaching in schools was not what you have today. First of all, most of the teachers were just qualified. If you had your senior high matriculation, they'd give you a temporary license to teach, and they'd be teaching stuff they didn't even know about. So, you know, they had no training at all. So you're kind of left on your own. And then at that time, towards the end of the war, they didn't say, well, you've got to go and go to university. You've got to go. So you got to grade 9, and they didn't think your parents had enough money to send you to university. They discouraged it. Oh, why don't you find a job and do this, you know. So I was always did everything on my own. And then I see these young kids in junior high, some beginners, little babies and that, you know. I feel sorry for them. Oh, you can do that. You keep going. Because I knew that I didn't come into this business as a natural musician or whatever they want to call it. I come in, and I'm one of the people that knows it's 99% work and 1% talent. Well, I had half that 1%. So I feel everybody can play if they want to. Yeah.
And you've also been good to other band directors. You knew the charts, you knew their bands, you knew what would sound good for them. There's also a mentoring of people who are already in the workplace, people who are maybe experienced conductors but need somebody to just give them the thumbs up every now and again.
Yeah, well, I mean, they even asked me, you know, how did I tie my shoes? I'll show you how to do that. You know, I don't look at the person, well, look, I got a 14 degrees here now, and mentally, you know, you're visualizing this when I really don't have time for you, but check so-and-so. But I never tell them to go to someone else. I say, here's what I would do, and here's what you should go see. But I always got a remedy for somebody, because you go through so many of them, eh?
When you see adult musicians like this, people who are doing it just because they love to, what do you think?
Well, that's exactly what it is. You know, you always used to say, and I forget who this was. I know he was a professional conductor, but he'd get up in front of the band, and he says, you know, I really enjoy him. This guy's a big shot, you know. And he'd say, you know, he says, do you people know the difference between a professional and an amateur musician? And they said, no. Well, a professional musician has to play, but an amateur musician plays because they love to play. And that just stays right there, and it is true. You know, I mean, even if they can't play, they still try to play the damn thing. And the thing is, you have to be able to at least control your mental factors that you don't get upset. Because you do get upset, you know, 3 or 4 times, okay, but 10 times. You just have to be a bit edgy. And, you know, if you stop and think, well, look, he's getting edgy too, because he's feeling embarrassed. So then you stop, we'll get it later, and just move on.
The tribute this weekend, clearly a lot of people wanted to say thank you. Yes. And it was a very emotional evening last night. Yes. When you were watching all these people and Howard Cable phoned and all, yes. what were you thinking?
I didn't know what to think, really. I was just saying, my God, all these people, you know. And you know, I've known Howard for a long, long time. And when something comes from him, that's really, you know, he's got the perfect words all the time. But, you know, and you just don't expect it from people of him. But, you know, I just don't realize what I'm doing. I just keep on doing it. And to see that all come out, because it's different. If it was the Football Association that was giving me a plaque for running on the gym floor 5 or 6 times, okay, thanks very, very much. I appreciate it, of course. But when it comes to the people you've worked with and people you've taught and people you've known, and particularly people like Howard, I really got high, high respect for him, and really high. And other people, Jim Harker is another mentor of mine. I just don't know what to say. It just overwhelms me. I'm still trying to come down from it, really, because you can't get up there and you don't know how to come down. You don't want to be, I can't do that stuff anyway.
What's your greatest achievement?
Oh, my God. I don't know. I think my greatest achievement right at this particular point in time is the fact that what I did worked, really. And it will continue to work. And if so many, and it's also working for other people. So that was my thing. I remember last night, and I don't like making speeches, but I said there's only about 4 different statements I got for everybody. So when I was in the Navy, you had the courage of your convictions, so what I thought was should be correct, I should be able to support that. And lead by example, that's another leadership thing. So I led by example by being the best musician I could. But the one that really stuck in my life was when I moved to Truro. We finally had time to go to a church, because in the Navy, you know, I made 13 moves in 7 years. So it's hard to raise a family that way. So I used to go to the United Church. Reverend Mumford was there, great guy. And he used to have the band come and play in his church, and to the extent that the organist was getting upset that they were there to do the music, not. And he says, well, I'm the minister and I call the shots. But he was ex-military too. And anyway, I'd get along and I'd get tired and I just couldn't go. So when I went to church, I was coming out the door and I said, look, Reverend, I'm really sorry. I missed the last few services. I just been a little bit too tired. He says, don't you apologize for that. I said, why? He said, because God maybe didn't put you here to come to church on Sunday morning. He put you here to do exactly what you're doing now, looking after kids and doing music. So you just do that. I think you'll appreciate that more when you come to church. So that stuck with me. And it's a bit of a religious vein that nobody knows in me. So I feel that, well, my gosh, I'm coming from that guy. Maybe that's the way I should lead. You know.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's a conversation I had with Ron McKay last fall at St. Anne's Gaelic College, the weekend that his friends and former students got together to pay tribute to his life's work. And we wanted to play the concert for you. It was wonderful. There were several conductors involved. Rowan Fitzgerald from Prince Edward Island, one of the conductors. Maggie Helms from the mainland was there. Laura Mercer was the MC for the afternoon, and Mr. McKay took the baton a couple of times himself.